Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Mindcastle podcast. Just a quick reminder, we are now on YouTube if you want to see our lovely faces and a little show and tell, which is going to be some of this episode. We are talking about essentialism today and what it is, how it affects our lives, and how it can impact our lives, hopefully for the better. So Reagan's going to be taking point on this one because he's the one that read the book, and I haven't yet, but he says I'm supposed to. So... anyway, Reagan, if you could kick us off, what is essentialism?
Yeah, so you've heard of minimalism.
I have.
No way.
Yeah, I know, shocker.
No way. Yeah, like everybody and their pet dog has heard of minimalism. Probably because it's so visibly obvious.
Yeah.
Minimalist being, you know, less of everything, don't own anything, you know, get rid of all the stuff. There's this whole, like, go through your house and pick up each item and does it spark joy or is it useful? And if it's not, then get rid of it. And to be honest, there is a lot of people who need to do that in their life. So I'm not harsh on minimalism. It has some real upsides, but it also at some point has its downsides. A little more balanced, I would say, is essentialism. Mm. Which has almost nothing to do with physical possessions, actually. whereas I almost called it materialism. Minimalism has everything to do with your material possession. Like,
yeah.
Materialism, it's like, for me, it's almost like another form of materialism. Anyway, right. Essentialism has a lot more to do with mindsets and the matrix that you use for deciding what to do with your time, basically.
Very interesting.
Awesome stuff. This is easily the best book, I'm going to say, that I've read this year.
Okay.
So yeah, do pick it up. It's pretty short. Pretty easy reading, lots of cool like drawings and stuff in it. Nothing, there's no rocket science in here. So you're going to read it and be like, that's actually really basic. And I can't believe I've never thought of that.
Hmm.
It's one of those kind of books, honestly. So it's by Greg McKeown. And yeah, it instantly sold more of a million copies. So yeah, it's worth getting. So to define essentialism, we're just going to jump right in and then you can... yeah, let me know. So
is the book just called Essentialism? That's it?
Yes, Essentialism. He wrote a follow-up to it as well that I can't remember the name here right now, but I'm going to definitely get it the first chance I can. Yeah, I think he's put a lot of stuff
links
out
down
there.
In the description for the book.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, go down and pick it up on Amazon. You can get them for a couple bucks used.
And it's an affiliate, so we can maybe buy a coffee if you buy like 100 copies.
So yeah, if every single person on this podcast were to buy this book at full price, we might have enough money to buy half of a Starbucks coffee.
Yes.
Because you go to Starbucks now, guess what?
$9 or
$9.
Sheesh.
For like, dude, there was another coffee shop I was at. Like nothing fancy. I just want me a cup of coffee, as in latte. $6.50. I was like, you're kidding me. So guess what we're doing right now? We're drinking instant coffee.
We have stepped to a new level, people.
From Iraq, actually. This is Mahmoud coffee. So if you know, you know. All my friends from Iraq or people that have been to Iraq,
it's good.
You know. It's good stuff. This is like one of so many memories. Anyways, moving on to what is essentialism? This podcast is so meta because we're not hitting the essential thing. We're getting distracted. That's the whole point, though. This is actually like a nice case in point.
Yeah, that was all just a big example.
That wasn't actually kind of was. So he said this. The basic premise of the book is almost everything in life is noise. Very few things are actually essential.
Mm.
The sum is less is better. This is page 5. The subtitle actually is The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. So it's not I keep saying materialism instead of minimalism. Wow, that's kind of funny actually because it's so ironic. It's so true. Minimalism is more like just get rid of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Essentialism is saying find the very few things in life that are the most important and double down on those because those are the ones that are really worth living for.
Yeah.
It's kind of some of the vibes of like the 4,000 weeks concept. You're only going to be alive for 4,000 weeks, you know, like spend them on the things that are actually worth spending them on. You know, it's a little bit of that, but it doesn't go. I like the approach a lot better.
Okay.
So anyway, so that's the basic premise. And again, there's all kinds of cool drawings and art in it and stuff. That's great that he just doodled in here. A big quote, if you're watching on YouTube, is like, this is size 80 font or something on the page. He'll do that when there's like a really key point. So this is the first one of those.
Forget bold, man.
No, this is like half a page. So it says, if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will.
Mm-hmm.
Big and facts. What he's meaning by that is simply, if you don't prioritize, other things in life will eat up your time, attention mm-hmm. and energy. And then I think we did I think we touched on this. We need to do a full episode on it. There's a fabulous book called The Productivity Project, where he basically said, honestly, when you boil it all down, productivity is about balancing your time, energy, and attention. And if you don't prioritize, in this case, he's saying your life or those three things, because they're like the, some of the most valuable things. If you don't prioritize those, somebody else will, or something else will. External factors, your boss, your whatever, will prioritize them for you. Which is kind of unfortunate. It's life. He has a lot to say about modern society, social pressures, things like that. And we're not going to get into all that, but he's got some really good points. He said, we're unprepared because, and he's talking about the explosion of material goods and, and choice, because for the first time, the preponderance of choice has overwhelmed our ability to manage it. As in, the choices have gotten so much, and so there's so many possibilities that it is beyond our physical, mental ability and emotional ability to manage it. It's just too overboard. It's too much. And I was just reading another book about that very thing. It's called Margin, which is a great book. He's a medical doctor, and he's going through like diagnosing that very issue of like, hey, Industrial Revolution, you know, Enlightenment, all those things were fine because they gave us like air conditioning or something, say. But it created so many choices, it's beyond our mental ability to actually handle it. So he's making the same point in this book. That's another great book that you should also read called Margin. Another one to
links in the description.
Actually go ahead and link that. Going back to priority. So this blew my mind. The word priority, this is quoting from page 16, the word priority came into the English language in the 1400s. It was singular. It meant the very first or prior thing. It stayed singular for the next 500 years. Only in the 1900s did we pluralize the term and start talking about priorities. Illogically, we reasoned that by changing the word, we could bend reality. Somehow, we could now be able to do multiple first things. People and companies routinely try to do just that. One leader told me of his experience in a company that talked of priority one, priority two, priority three, priority four, and priority five. This gave the impression of many things being the priority, but it actually meant nothing was.
Interesting.
Which I'm just like, oh my goodness, we're only 16 pages in the book and my brain is like, he's so right. This, and that's what I'm saying about this book. It's so profound, but it's so simple. This is all stuff I like, I kind of knew that, but I just like, I need somebody to tell me and be like, like that's not right. Like I would often on my to-do list be like, I'd have like five things listed as first priority for the day. What? You can't, like that is not possible. And so then when you go to work that day and you're like, what am I going to work on right now to start the day? And I have five priorities. You know what I ended up doing instead? None of them. I sit on email and do email instead, you know, because like that's just easier. So anyways.
Interesting. Did we really talk about who this guy is? Because that might be helpful for some people. Like you were, we were talking about this before the episode started a little bit. Like you have the, you have my level of productivity hacks and stuff. And you have like the big YouTubers like Ali Abdaal and Mandy Bella and Thomas Frank and all that. And then you have like billionaire productivity hacks.
Right.
And like, I'm guessing this is kind of where that guy falls into.
So yeah, so that's a great point. So when it comes to life coaching and life advice and self-help and productivity and, you know, bettering ourselves, all great things. But yeah, you do have like what I would call beginner tier stuff, which again, you know, Ali Abdaal is a great example. Great stuff. Like seriously, the guy has helped me with, you know, just basic time management and hey, this piece of software will help you this way, you know, take better notes. Great stuff. But at some point that level kind of taps out. That would be like entry level. Then you have, you know, more mid level, you know, but then you start getting more into that elite level of Fortune 100 CEOs. And those guys, they did not just show up there. Like these guys are legit. They're the best in the world at what they do. And we have a lot to learn from those guys. I don't know if I would put that guy at this level, but he's getting close in my opinion. So I'll tell you a little bit about it. So he's a speaker, bestselling author. I'm just looking at the bottom here. He's been covered by like New York Times, Fast Company, Fortune, you know, Inc. Incorporate, you know, like one of the most popular bloggers on all of LinkedIn. you know, he's young global leader for the World Economic Forum. Like, okay, that's, you don't just do that. Like versus, you know, Matt Diavello, what's his credentials? You know, so like this guy has actually been around the block and stuff. Not as much as some other books, but I've been kind of getting into that level of, you know, another one is Peter Partaker. In his book, Three Alarms. And you're like, okay, you open that book up and you're like, this is his manifesto on life and productivity in like 80 pages. Very simple, very condensed, boom. And he's, I mean, you know, one of the number one coaches in the world or something like that.
Which I think, to be fair, a lot of those are not going to apply to a lot of people because a lot of people aren't going to have the discipline and the priorities and like and the discipline and the wherewithal to actually nail that stuff down, which I think
possibly.
So there's a bit of a balance because in some ways you need people that you need to take advice from people that are like way beyond where you are, but also take advice from people where you want to go, where they're at. I think that's also kind of valuable. So like,
so
if you take someone like this versus someone,
like Eric Partaker, I mean, he'd be like, he's $50,000 a year for coaching.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like one session a month. I mean, it's like, you know, he's at the billionaire level.
Yeah.
I will say this. I agree. However, I believe once you've gotten started, got the basics down, right? In whatever topic it is, take whatever skill set you're trying to learn, then you need to level it up from that to stay, you know, in your lane of like what your capabilities are, but then also balance it with going to the very, very, very best that there is in that world. So like, say you're in health and fitness. A good example of that would be working out with someone who's maybe just a little ahead of you and just enough to push you and keep getting you better, but then also be seeing the habits and lifestyle and, you know, the best of the best CrossFit athlete, you know, and using that. So then you have that nice spread.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really important to do. And I feel like I didn't really do that in some area, well, in a lot of areas until last year. And we did some podcasts on this idea of getting a coach or a mentor or whatever. You know, the best athletes in the world all have a coach.
Yeah.
You know, and life is really complicated. Having someone who has done some of these things before and can help you out and give you advice is like, once you do it, it's like, well, why, duh. Like, this is so helpful. You know, and I had that experience last year where someone who had done a lot of the things I was trying to do and is much older than me, has way more life experience, came alongside and said, hey, like, seems like you kind of tapped out here. Like, you've gotten as far as you can get. Like, do you want some help? And I was just flabbergasted that they would do that. And I was so thrilled. And within like a month of weekly coaching or whatever you want to call them, sessions, like, we were at a totally different level than where I had been before. And so I would use that as an example of that was someone who for me at least, had like reached the pinnacle of where I wanted to go.
Yeah.
And I could,
that's a good point. That's a good point.
Anyway,
build that foundation and then like, not that you're going to become that person that's the perfect expertise. Like, I think that's important to like applying it. Yeah. Anyway, not sure what I'm saying, but like,
I feel like that was a really important bunny trail actually. So like,
you're trying to be that person.
No,
you're just taking the little aspects that really apply and like going with
it. So yeah. I do not recommend this person, but it is a great example is Alex Hormozi.
No idea who that is.
Like, ridiculously successful businessman who has started doing the content game, like YouTube podcasts, in the last year and a half and went from nothing to like zillions of followers in no time. Like, the guy's insane. Really high performer. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars and whatever. And his thing is about fast tracking the learning. So like, okay, I'm here. I want to be there. How do I find someone who has done that journey and is there and is willing to coach me? And I'll pay him whatever, because he's pretty wealthy. Right. I'll pay him whatever it takes. Get me there and get as far as that person can take you. And then once you've reached that level, okay, now find the next person.
Yeah.
And like, he's just constantly doing that. So he went and he's like, I want to start a YouTube channel. I wonder how fast can we blow this thing up? So he went out and found like the best agency he could find to do his YouTube for him. And was like, teach me everything you know about YouTube. I have no idea. This guy he owned gyms. Like, he was like a workout dude. Like,
I'm surprised that he wanted to learn that instead of hiring an expert.
Yeah. Oh yeah. When he's like, I'm going to hire you. We're going to make these videos and you're going to teach me and all my team to do everything that you do. And I'll pay you whatever you want. And he went from nothing to at an elite level in no time because he basically siphoned like decades of experience off of this agency. And they were happy to do that. They're like, well, sure, for an extra price, like, we'll teach you whatever. So now, obviously, you and I aren't rich enough to do something like that, you know, but I'm saying that idea is like huge.
Yeah.
Where
a little niceness and a little like kindness, and you'll get a lot of expertise just from asking. Like, you don't always have to throw money at people.
By purely osmosis, like just simply by being around these people, you know,
yeah.
Which again is why I like this guy, because he has done that. Again, global leader, you know, young global leader, you know, of the World Economic Forum. Like, oh, whoa, okay. Yeah, that's a pretty prestigious or a pretty, you know, difficult thing to achieve. Mm-hmm. So anyways, we're gonna keep going on essentials.
I feel like we got a good backdrop for all of this now.
And it feels like that's a whole nother topic to dial in on, like how to rocket fuel building a skill set.
Ooh, yeah.
So, okay.
Tim Ferriss.
Man. So like a good example of this fast tracking, you know, our learning, like I got asked to teach a course at a college, or kind of like a college-ish college, Faith Builders. I've never done anything like that. I'm totally clueless. Like my kinds of trainings are like hands-on, like wilderness, leadership stuff. And I'm like, oh my goodness, academics. I love academics, but I'm going to get hammered. Like, what am I doing? By the way, come take my class. It's at winter term 2024. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be on the Middle East. And it's going to be a party. I have no idea what I'm doing. So you know what I did? Instead of trying to figure it out and like bumble along forever, I just like started asking people who had taught there and said, send me everything you've got on how you did your classes. What books should I read? Everything. What assignments should I do? Talk about fast tracking. Like, good night. I can just download it from them. And they were super awesome and be like, yeah, here's everything you need. I was like,
nice.
Cool. Saving me like 50 hours, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, moving back on to essentials.
We got this.
We got this. We might need to turn this into a two-parter. Okay. When examining our lives, here's the essentialist approach, which I kind of lost. I'm not even sure where it is. Oh, yeah. Okay. The essentialist approach. Number one, explore and evaluate. So does this make the highest contribution towards my goal? Second point is to, you guessed it, eliminate getting rid of those things that are going to get in the way or distract you or whatever it may be. Because first, when you evaluate what's most important, second, it's okay, get rid of this. Mm-hmm. This is really hard for us to do because of decision fatigue, there's so many options, and there's this sense of a sunk cost bias. I'm like, well, I've already put so much into this other thing, but it's like, oh, but it's pulling me away.
Yeah.
You got to cut it off. You got to eliminate.
See, that's my problem. I have a lot of things like that.
Yeah. So, and then the third one is execute. I mean, it's like not rocket. Again, this is like not rocket science, but it's like really helpful. As in sticking with the highest level of contribution. Like, stick with that thing, execute that thing. You know, it's, and his point is, you know, essentialism is about creating a system for handling the closet of our lives, like all those things that kind of pile up, and like stick with it. The essence, what is the core mindset of an essentialist to get this as well? This is where it gets less into tactics and more into mindset. And this is really, really helpful for me. So the first one is individual choice. We choose how to spend our energy and time. Without choice, there is no point in talking about trade-offs. Number two, the prevalence of noise. Almost everything is noise, and a very few things are exceptionally valuable. This is a justification for taking time to figure out what is most important, because some things are so much more important. The effort in finding these things is well worth the time invested. That's really important.
Yeah.
Very few people feel like they have the time to sit down for a whole afternoon and evaluate what's noise and what's the stuff that's actually important for my life and what will move me forward in the way that I want to go.
Right.
That's really hard because it feels, it's so unproductive though. Like you just sat in a coffee shop for 4 hours and journaled, like, come on, you know, and that's really hard. But it's also, I would argue, about the most important thing you could do with an afternoon.
Yeah.
Number three, the reality of trade-offs. We can't have it all or do it all. If we could, there would be no reason to evaluate or eliminate options. Once we accept the reality of trade-offs, we stop asking, how can I make it all work? And start asking the more honest question, which problem do I want to solve?
Interesting.
That one blew my mind. I was like, oh. See, I tend to be a little bit ambitious, a little bit. So I'm just like,
yeah.
2020 comes along, like, no factor. Full-time in college, working full-time. Traveling the world because we're doing this thing with this nonprofit, which involves tons of travel. We're building a house and there's this global pandemic happening. No problem. I can do them all. We survived the year, but it was a terrible idea because I don't think I did any of those five things nearly as well as I could have because I was trying to do all of them at the same time, which is kind of dumb. And I was asking, how do I make it all work? And I should have been asking, which problem do I want to solve?
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to write that down.
Yeah, it's just trade-offs, you know?
So that was, okay, so you said, instead of asking, how do I make this all work, ask, which problem do I want to solve?
Which problem do I want to solve? Because we like to think we can solve multiple problems all the time. And it's just like, in reality, no, like you're bouncing between one and the other. Like you have to choose which mm-hmm. problem am I going to tackle this morning? Kind of comes back to that priorities. If you have seven priorities on your list, I mean, it's like, well, which one comes first when you wake up?
I really like that.
And I've started doing some of this stuff where I actually wrote this in my newsletter. Subscribe to my newsletter, by the way, because it's pretty legit. I did this newsletter where I was taking some of the stuff from this book and also some of those like high elite performers that I was starting to read about, like Fortune 100 type guys. Mm. It's like, what separates them from the rest of us, basically? Like
lowly folk.
Yeah, like, because honestly, there's something pretty special about them. Like, they've been able to, like, Elon Musk, I mean, like, change the world, you know, basically. Mm. Like, what does he do? It comes down to habit formation. You know, and the reality of trade-offs, and like they eliminate a lot of extra stuff. Like they just don't spend a lot extra on this, that, or whatever stuff that we do probably. Hmm. And some of that has to do, they have more capital to.
Yeah, that definitely makes a difference.
It does help. But it does tend to be like, what problem am I going to solve? And they're just going
right.
to tackle that thing.
Now, are they choosing that on like a daily basis, weekly basis? Or like, how do they, that's kind of my thing. Cause we do.
Elon Musk does on a daily basis. If you look at his schedule, it's like, if I get this, this may have changed a little bit, but it was like 2 days at SpaceX, 2 days at Tesla, and 1 day at Twitter, I think was the last I'd heard.
Okay.
And so he does like this time blocking thing. Mm-hmm. So that was where I was going with that. The concept of time blocking and like actually build it into your calendar. So I put this on as one of those high performing habits of sit down, create a new calendar on Google Calendar. Literally go do this if you're listening to this. Call it Ideal Week.
Right.
You don't have to use this. This is just for brainstorming, and block in for the entire day what you would idealize, the perfect week that you would spend your time on. That is incredibly clarifying. Right? And then you look at that calendar and compare it to your current calendar and see, okay, what gives?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, yeah, sure, there's practical stuff. That, hey, got to earn money, got to this, got to that. I get that. I'm just trying to get out of that box of like, what is the ideal? And suddenly the amount of clarity that comes around of what is the most important thing, mm-hmm. what is the most important problem I'm trying to solve is like so clear, so quickly. So I've actually been living out of my ideal calendar for a while. And most times I don't stick to it because real life happens, but it's so nice. Every morning I look at that, it's like, that's the ideal that I'm aiming for. I want to be doing this kind of work. I want to be helping these kind of people. These are the things that are valuable to me, and it's blocked in on my calendar, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of you show up to work, you're like, well, what are we going to do today? And you spend all morning answering emails. Is that truly in your ideal week? Now, there will be days that that happens, but like, is that really the most valuable problem you can solve right now?
Mm.
So guess what? I'm not really doing that much anymore. You know, like it was like, oh, the most valuable thing I can be doing is, anyway, we can get into that another time, but.
I really like that. And that's something I got from Ali Abdullah a while back, is he kind of did the same thing as like with new calendar, create a new calendar and like block in what an ideal week would look like. Mm-hmm. His was more from the angle of like, what work do you need to do? Mm-hmm. And like, how much time do you need for your work? Less, more about that and less about like what problems are most important for you to solve. But I really like that.
And maybe a problem is the wrong word for some people.
Well, but for brainstorming, mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the notes I have on my YouTube script is like at the top of all of my scripts, it just says like, what problem am I trying to solve? Like, because if you're not trying to solve a problem, then like, are you really helping people that much? I mean,
yeah,
you know,
exactly. Because like some people would be like, oh, if it was my ideal week, I would be, you know, in the Bahamas all the time, you know, or in Hawaii. And I'm like, okay, realistically, your ideal week that you idealize spending your time on is almost certainly going to come back to helping someone
or
problem solving for someone. It will actually probably come back to some kind of work.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, oh, you know, you can't live in vacation all the time. Yeah. Okay. You know, you start getting a ton of clarity around it. So he has this great chart right here that I wish we could show better, but this is a podcast. So there's three rings. One is the right thing, the right reason, and the right time.
Hmm.
And where all three of those intersect in the middle, that's the highest point of contribution. That's the most, that's the essence. That's the piece you should focus on.
What were the three?
Right thing, like what is it?
Okay.
Right reason, as in why are you doing it? Right time, when.
What, why, when.
Yeah. And where those three rings intersect, that's your highest point of contribution or the highest valuable output that you could do.
Hmm.
So like, I don't know. I'm trying to think, like, there's some stuff we do with the other podcasts I help run, you know, Antipops Perspectives. And it can be very, very easy to get focused on all the minutia, but like, what's right. the highest point of contribution? It's actually me hosting podcasts. Cause if we don't make podcasts, the whole thing falls apart. So like, that's the highest point of contribution. And it's so easy to get totally lose that. And it's like, oh, it's, you know,
finding this cool new software or like hiring this person to do whatever.
It's and like, it's just like, no, the most important thing is for me to make podcasts, you know, in that particular scenario. There's always other stuff to do, but so anyways, hey, guess what? We're only 22 pages into the book here. this is really crazy. So then each piece breaks down those four pieces. Mm-hmm. What's the essence? How do we discern or explore the many from the few? And then the elimination. And then the execution phase that we had talked about. So the rest of the book is in those four parts.
This what, why, when, that's really huge because that kind of wraps up the whole essentialism in general, or like in some ways of like execution, which I think is where most people are going to fall short in all this, is essentialism is really, really appealing. It's like, okay, yeah. But then like, what's that take? Like what does that look in execution? Like, is that taking an afternoon off to go sit in a coffee shop and journal? Or is that like, how do you decide, you know, between these 10 things, what is right for right idea, right reason, right when, or right time, you know, for which of these 10 things falls into that? Or what if they all fall into that? Or, you know, what about that?
That's a tough one. So the first one is the essence. Like what's the core mindset of the essentialist?
Yeah.
And the first point there was that he has is chapter number two called Choose. And he does tell a little slice of his story. I don't know if you can read that chunk if you want to get some,
yeah, that
some
might be
practical
helpful.
Stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. I stared wide-eyed at the piece of paper in my hands. I was sitting in the foyer of a high-rise office building. He was basically doing some brainstorming as a like, what direction should I go with my life? As I looked at the paper, I was mostly struck by what wasn't on it. Law school was not on the list. Mm. This got my attention because I was halfway through my first year at law school in England. He's from England. He said, I had applied to study law because of repeated advice to keep your options open. Once I got out, I could practice law. I could write about law. I could teach law, or I could consult on the law. The world would be my oyster, or so the argument went. Yet from almost the first moment I started studying law, instead of choosing between the pursuits, I had simply tried to fit them all in. I would study my law books at all hours all day and read the great management thinkers in the evenings. In spare moments, I would write. It was a classic straddling strategy of attempting to invest in everything at once. The result was that while I was not entirely failing at any pursuit, I wasn't entirely succeeding at any either.
Ooh.
I soon began to wonder just what was so great about all these open options. In the middle of all this existential confusion, I received a call from a friend in the U.S. inviting me to his wedding. He had already bought tickets. I had already bought and sent the tickets. So I gratefully accepted the invitation and left England on an unexpected adventure. While in the United States, I took every opportunity to meet teachers and writers. One such meeting was with an executive for a nonprofit educational group. As I was leaving his office, he mentioned in passing, if you decide to stay in America, you could come and join us on a consultation committee. His passing comment had a curious force about it. It wasn't his specific question. It was the assumption he made that I had a choice.
Hmm.
Really key piece.
Yeah.
If you decide to stay. Mm-hmm. He saw it as a real option. I left his office and took the elevator down to the lobby, took a single sheet of paper from someone's desk and sat in the lobby and attempted to answer the question.
Pocket notebook, people.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly. Yeah. You need to give your brain the space to think through stuff like this. Whenever the moment happens, yeah. Attempting to answer the question, if you could only do one thing with your life right now, what would it be? One thing. That's the key piece. Mm-hmm. The result was that piece of paper on which law school, as I had indicated, was not written.
Hmm.
Up to that point, I'd always known logically that I could choose not to study law, but emotionally, I never saw it as an option. That's when I realized that in sacrificing my power to choose, I had made a choice, a bad one. Mm. By refusing to choose not to law school, I had chosen law school. Not because I had actually or actively wanted to be there, but by default. See, a lot of our decisions in life get made by default.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, well, you know, it just kind of happens. I think that's when I first realized that when we surrender our ability to choose, something or someone else will step in and choose for us. Hmm. A few weeks later, I officially quit law school. I left England and moved to America to start down the path of becoming an author and a teacher. You're reading this now because of this choice. Yet for all the impact this specific choice has had on the trajectory of my life, I value the way it changed my view about choices even more. We often think of choice as a thing, but a choice is not a thing. A choice is an action. Mm-hmm. It is not just something we have, but something that we do. This experience brought me to the liberating realization that while we may not always have full control of our options, which is a really good point, don't always have full control of our options, we always have control on how we choose among them. Yeah, and this is like the challenge of the modern age. I mean, there's many options. It's like, what do we do? You know, and realizing that a choice is an action. It's a really, really key point. The ability to choose cannot be taken away or even given away. It can only be forgotten. It's one of the key parts of the book. And he goes into some different experiences of that. You know, like, so the non-essentialist is going to say things like, I have to. Or the essentialist is going to say, I choose to. And some people be like, yeah, but like, how does that work? Because, you know, with your job and everything, it's like you still chose that. It's like you still choose to show up to work every day and work that job, even though it's like maybe you don't want to, maybe it's your boss, you're only doing it because your boss is telling you to, whatever, but you still did choose that. You have to keep that in mind, that there is choice there. And it's actually a concept from the book, you know, Man's Search for Meaning, which goes a completely different angle, but his thing is you can still always choose,
right?
You can never take that away from someone. Or you can choose the and this is a thing from 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, again, the stimulus and the response and the gap between the two, you can choose how you look at it and how you view it. Mm-hmm. So this is pretty similar to that.
That's really good. Wow.
Yeah.
Wowzers. I need to read that book.
It's really good. And then, you know, that's just chapter one. Chapter two is called Discern, with the subtitle of The Unimportance of Practically Everything. there's so much here. A key piece for that, back to Discern. It's easy to think of jobs in terms of that ratio between time and reward. What really counted was the relationship between time and results. It's like, oh God, what a great point, you know? So, but yeah, we're just barely getting started on this book. Either we can move faster or we could do a two-parter.
I feel like we need to do a two-parter. I'm going to see if I can buy it real quick just because I feel like I want this book.
Okay. So a couple, while he's quick buying it on Amazon.
As everyone one else should be doing.
Yes, as you should. And I can recommend this pretty highly. Another quote. A non-essentialist thinks almost everything is essential. An essentialist thinks almost everything is non-essential. Which kind of rubbed me the wrong way initially, but when you actually sit down and really think about it, it's like, how many of the things that I own or the things that I do every day are like really, really essential in the highest level or the highest leverage, most important activities? It's actually kind of scary. Like, not saying I won't do those things. It's very clear, but it's really important for me to realize I wouldn't have to do that. Like, it is not right.
It's a choice.
Critical. Yeah. And realizing how much of that is happening in my life, even after reading this book.
I think the hard part about that is we don't like to give up that sense of importance that it gives us, maybe. When we feel like we're trying to do everything. I don't know. There's a weird like sense of significance that comes from that, I feel like, or sense of control or familiarity with the noise or something.
I'm
not quite sure.
Some of this comes back to humanity has changed a lot, so like even our grandfather's generation, the majority were, you know, farming, say, you know, or factory workers. Like your choices and the way you lived, it was very slimmed down. You know, like when you're running a farm, I mean, that's what you're doing, you know, like
a lot of options there.
Yeah. And in a lot of ways that was bad, right? Because there were plenty of people working on a farm that really didn't want to, and they would have loved to have done something else, and they could have been the next, you know, Mozart or something. Okay, granted. But there is a pretty big difference between how humanity has often lived, that much simpler and slower life versus where we are now. And the change happens so quickly that society hasn't really had the chance to adapt. And I think we're pretty ill-equipped
I think so
for everything. And then you've got like TikTok or whatever exploiting that, that vulnerability. So that, yeah, so they can sell ads and, you know, steal all your money and stuff.
Steal your face.
Yeah. And steal your data and you know, so yeah, exactly. So that's a whole nother podcast.
We should do an episode on that.
On Incogni.
Did you know?
I got Incogni.
Oh, really?
The software to see how many places my stuff is on databases around the world. It was terrifying, man.
Johnny Harris finally got through.
No, I actually got it for free because I did a thing with the, anyway, it's a story about techie stuff that nobody's going to care about. Yeah. Anyway. So we got started on this book. We hit the key points. We were in the essence, like the core mindset of an essentialist. Maybe we should end it there. And then the next bit we could do, dive into a little more of the second part, which is like the exploring part. How do we discern between what's trivial and not trivial?
I think that's going to be really interesting.
And because once you've discerned it, that's, for me, that's the hard part.
Right.
But some people actually find the harder part is the next phase, which is eliminating it. Yeah, it's really hard to let us go stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe let's hit those two on the next one. And then the fourth one, okay, it all depends on who you are. The fourth one for me, piece of cake, execute, man. All right, we made a call. Let's go. But like some people, they actually really struggle with that. They can plan and plan and plan, but then not actually execute. Execution is everything. Because like you can do all this stuff, but you don't actually execute on these decisions where you end up, nowhere. So maybe we could hit those three on the next episode. I didn't plan on, I mean, we're only at page 48 here, so.
That's usually how these book reviews go.
Because there is just so much here of, again, I've been writing about it a lot in my newsletter of those things like the high performance habits and things and like how those people live. And it's usually around the calculus of what is the highest value thing I can do right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It'd be like Elon Musk going and doing the bookkeeping for Tesla. Like it'd be stupid because the highest value thing he can do is, you know, I don't know, working with investors or engineering or actually, honestly, it's probably engineering. He's like stupid good at problem solving, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Super good. I'm excited to keep going in this book. And I just bought it. So if you're listening, watching, you should buy it too.
I would recommend you actually buy it. Because there's like charts and stuff in it.
Yeah.
Don't listen to it as an audiobook.
Yeah.
Because you want to take this one pretty slow and like mark it up and write in the corner.
Oh yeah. You know, my favorite thing to do.
I wrote a newsletter about that too, of like the beauty of like physical books. Ebooks are for the birds, man. I want to be able to write in them things. Anyways.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So anyway, I think it's going to wrap up this episode. We're going to continue on next time, hopefully, unless we forget and decide to do something else. So anyway, thank you so much for watching/listening. If you haven't already, it might seem kind of small to you, but a review actually helps us out a lot. You can leave that on Apple Podcasts if you would like. And so if you haven't already as well, subscribe to Reagan's newsletter that he's plugged like 7,000 times in this video.
My newsletter is so good. No, I'm just kidding. You don't have to, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. We have a lot of fun in different avenues and stuff. So anyway, hope you enjoy this episode and we'll catch you in the next one.